Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
You're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Lady Sue. And what do? When I'm not hosting Word of Mouth? I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here, and working with my clients, which include chefs, sommeliers, big brand startups, all those doing what's most innovative and delicious. I recently headed out to San Francisco and the Bay Area to talk to food folks out there for our SF sessions. They're not live, but they're on location. So on today's Word of Mouth, we're recording on April 30th, 2014, from the studios of our partner company, Stitcher. It's a handy app. It's kind of like Pandora, but for radio shows and for podcasts. And you can use Stitcher to listen to your favorite stuff on demand and on a go. And we're here with chef owner Charles Van of The Slanted Door, Hard Water, The Coachman, and so on and so forth. He's got 7 properties in total. And perhaps what is most impressive is that his restaurants are got so much love, on the bucket lists of everyone who comes into town, and he's been in business for almost 20 years. Hey, Charles.
Hi.
Thanks so much for coming in here today.
Thanks for having me.
I can only imagine how busy your days get with 3 kids and 7 restaurants.
A little bit. That's good, though.
So we had a chance to catch up at Hard Water. What a beautiful space, and such a fun list of everything brown and delicious.
Yeah, yeah. The brown stuff, the bourbon, is very dear to my heart. and I definitely drink more than I should.
So tell me about that concept. You know, it's absolutely a lot of fun.
Well, I parked my car. It's next door to the ferry building. There's a parking lot in Pier 3, and there was a little empty spot. And I did a charity cookout for La Cocina. Mm-hmm. Made some fried chicken. It was a big hit, and we did, I don't know, $12,000 like in 6 hours, and raised some money for La Cocina. I thought, oh, cool, I'll do a little fried chicken shack.
And let's tell the audience about La Cocina, because I love it, and...
La Cocina, it's a nonprofit that trained, you know, immigrant group how to start up in the food business. So they have a little kitchen. They teach you how to fill out form and get your food truck permit. And but they also have a kitchen for you to learn how to make food. So, and every year, it's their mission is to create these graduates go out in the real world to make money with food, whether or not it's selling candy or making a dumpling of some sort. And every year, you got to come here, I think it's around August, in some, you know, sunny Mission, just thousands of people take over, you know, 4 or 5 blocks of street fair. It's really cool. Mm-hmm. And, you know.
So you're cooking, and then?
So the fried chicken was that was the idea. It was mm-hmm. really small space, about 1,400 square feet. And then I signed the lease, and I found out I could get a liquor license really cheap because we're on port property. And my partner and architect and good friend of mine, Ole Lundberg, and I said to him, I think we got to do some bourbon because, you know, there's like 2 things I love. And he got excited, and next thing you know, we spent like, I don't know, $200,000 in bourbon, collecting, buying bourbon.
From eBay?
Well, the eBay stuff was for our own personal collection. That we can't sell.
Right, but it's on display.
Yeah, so we can brag about it. It's terrible.
What's the coolest thing that you have on display there?
There's a lot of geekish things. I would say I can't really. One of my favorite is always a Hirsch 16-year-old. It's hard to get, and it's still out there, but it's still one of my, you know, dear favorite. And of course, there's pre-prohibition stuff, and they're just kind of cool to look at. And sometimes we might take a sip. I think we got a bar.
Wow.
So the bourbon, it's just all of a sudden the idea.
Pre-prohibition stuff, how does that taste? I mean, it sounds crazy.
If you ever get a chance to taste it, it's literally almost like saying, you know, in 1970 people like bell bottom because it's just a different aesthetic. It's more licorice, and the wood and the grain, the yeast were different back then. So mind you, this stuff would have been made in the 1890s. It was like 10 years, right? And this is pre-prohibition, so. I mean, the wood and everything is different. So you sort of like have a little sample history in time, like you're drinking liquid history, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really hard to get hold of that. And not all of them are good, because just because they're old doesn't mean.
Of course.
It could be some idiot back 1890 making that stuff. So you really don't know, and these brand doesn't exist. So it's a gamble, but it's kind of cool. But sometimes you just have it. To enjoy the label and maybe take a drop out of it and compare.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of great things that you can buy today and buy the small batch and small producer or single barrel stuff that are really good. And the more you taste and you start getting this landscape of different flavor and you find out, oh, this guy, that's why this guy tastes a lot more, tastes better, more expensive. It's all in your palate. We have a saying in Chinese, you can't really fool the tongue, right?
How do you say that in Chinese?
How do I say that in Chinese?
Wait, do you actually speak Chinese?
A little bit in Cantonese.
Oh, okay, okay.
Is
it one of those Chengyu, the sayings?
I think
like
so,
those four character sayings that like sound poetic and have some kind of life truth? Okay.
So
Chinese test over.
Chinese.
This is what it's like to get interviewed by a lady.
I could order in a Chinese menu. So
I can too.
I think that's about it.
Yeah, I talk about the food. That's it.
Yeah, mind you, when I left Vietnam, I was sixth grade, so my education sort of stopped there.
Well, your English is good.
Sort of. So anyway, so even someone who don't know bourbon, if you have something really good. Chances are you'll pick them out because it'll linger. The depth of flavors are longer, it's smoother going down. So you really don't have to be a snob to know what that is. And so I think that's really how we should treat our food and not worry about what the critics, you know, it's like, if you like it, it's all good to you.
So how many selections are on the list?
I want to say like 250 or something,
wow,
you know. So
rad.
We have these flight, you know, things hard to get, flight, you know. But also we go buy our own private barrel and you can get stuff that are under $10 that are – or $10 a shot that are good. And you work your way up, you know, all the way up to $200 a shot. So
hey, so is your drinking philosophy, do you drink the expensive stuff first and then – go into the cheaper stuff when you're too drunk to know, or what's like the right order for you?
That sounds about right.
Because, okay.
When you have a cocktail, it's a little less taste of the bourbon.
Yeah.
I usually start with a cocktail and quickly just go to straight bourbon because then you really taste and I do it straight up, no ice, maybe a little splash of water on the side.
And do you do the cocktail to start out with just to kind of ease into it?
Well, I mean, I got staff that spend a lot of time making cocktails. I feel like I should have at least one cocktail. If not, then they kind of get sad that I don't taste their drinks. You know? So
that's.
But personally, I tend to like the straight stuff, a little less sugar, less.
I saw that.
But the cocktail, you know, every now and then could be good, you know.
We're both people of Asian descent who are pretty good drinkers.
Little did I know. Sometimes I get red, but I can put them down. you know.
So tell me, let's run through the other spots that you own and run, because they're all really different and really fun. So
20 years ago, I had this idea, open slant door with a modern interior by Vietnamese food. So that's the flagship. Mm-hmm. Then I opened a baby version called Out the Door in a different neighborhood, a little less of slant door. And I kind of got into the museum, the Academy of Science, the Moss Rooms, because, you know, my wife and I want to, you know, change the way kids are fed. And in this case, it is in a museum. So we, you know, there was a bid with multiple chefs, and we end up getting the job, and we cook at the museum, cooking organic food, different food station, like a Mexican taco bar, a Vietnamese noodle shop, salad. That's one venue we did. Then we opened Hardwater. That was a Southern-inspired food with oyster right by the ocean, mm-hmm. and bourbon. Then I opened South, which is a San Francisco jazz institution, SF Jazz. They built a brand new building.
Wow.
The director, Randall Klein, you know, said, I got to come and help and be part of it. And we do all the catering. And we have a small restaurant at the Jazz Center, amazing music. Then recently, I took a existing property called Heaven's Dog and converted to the Coachman, which is English. And I can tell you later why I went to English.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the property. And we had a Chinese concept called Wuhing General Store,
mm-hmm.
and that didn't do well. We mm-hmm. shut that down about a year ago.
Why didn't that do well?
Had no idea. Same location that the original slant door, and don't know why. I loved it. We were making our own noodle.
So higher end Chinese food.
Yeah, we were making the Shanghai dumpling. Like I was doing with 00 flour from Italy and making Shanghai dumpling.
And oh, man.
All the noodle, all the hand-cut noodle.
You mean a xiaolongbao?
The xiaolongbao, mm-hmm. yeah. And I discovered that the Italian 00 flour is just much better at stretching the skin really thin.
Cool.
And steam and holding the broth. That was a lot of fun. And unfortunately, it didn't do well, so I shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of move on.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, the latest thing was the Coachman.
And why did you go into this English pub there?
Well, Dad, when we came to San Francisco in 1977, he got a job at busing table. I mean, he was a janitor. So a year later, 78, I got a job at busing table. That's mm-hmm. how I learned about the restaurant
mm-hmm.
industry. And I was in high school, and then I went to UC Berkeley and continued to work at a bunch of restaurants in San Francisco.
Congrats. Good school.
He passed away 7 years ago. He was 85, and
mm-hmm.
So I decided to go to London vacation with my family to commemorate him, and end up eating all these British restaurants and all like St. John and Hereford Row, and all of a sudden just the idea clicked, and I thought just it would be really fun to commemorate, you know, the beginning of my restaurant career at an English pub, and we're doing this modern English like St. John. Called the Coachman, and I renamed it exactly the name. A gentleman who started in the late 60s, Malcolm Strauss, who went out and opened a bunch of restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, crazy enough, recently his wife, he passed away, and his wife sent me a really great note saying she's so happy that I revived the name. She sent me a menu, and it showed the steak and kidney pie was like $4.20. They come with soup and salad and dessert. You know, that was the entree price in the 70s. Amazing. So,
wow.
That was really cool. And, you know, we're in town. We don't have any other restaurant. And we have a great team of folks. And we have people that are in the wine, Chili's in the wine, and Eric Atkins in the bar director. And we just want to create different venues. And also, I forgot to mention that I recently, about 2 years ago, started a catering arm called Green Cap. And, you know, we brought in someone who was in the catering for a while, director Tara, and started caterings. And because I was, like, on the road a lot doing all these charity cooking, and I figure I kind of need somebody who kind of manage that and mm-hmm. maybe do few jobs that we get paid, because most of the job we do is we don't get paid.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, going to, you know, last week, like, cooking at the Easter egg roll at the White House, that doesn't get paid. Or going to James Beard next week, you don't get paid.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we get one or two wedding jobs that we get paid. So,
and that's great because you have all the operations in place in order to, you know, execute that without disrupting the
right.
rest of your
restaurants. And it's just really, it's kind of nice. Before, I was just telling people to work double shift.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, somebody's got to cover somebody and they go and, you know, go on a road trip to, sometimes we go all the way to Vienna. And it could be taxing on the team. So now we have a division of that. But it's really about the team of doing something interesting. And now we have this family. I think we have, I don't know, 600 people working. So it's just a big, giant family. Everybody, you know.
600.
And I just got to go visit, you know, every one of them. Hopefully doing it in 2 week, 3 week span, you know, meeting up with the GM or the chef. We have a central kitchen. We have a commissary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of cool, too. It's a place where we develop a lot of our ideas. Like we were trying to make a Vietnamese sandwich and, you know, we have, you know, equipment and space to do it. So we have a 10,000 square foot commissary that's part of the catering arm and also mm-hmm. feeds all the restaurant.
Mm-hmm. You know, so you ideate a lot of stuff out of this commissary. How do you stay fresh after 20 years? Like, you know, where is your inspiration coming from? What's your creative process?
I don't like to repeat the stuff I've done.
Mm-hmm.
So the English thing, that was really nerve-wracking because for the first time, you know, I'm not cooking, you know, Chinese or Vietnamese food. And collaboration, finding new talent. And, like, the whole team went to London. And you're like a little kid again and drinking every cocktail, like, hitting six bar, like, you know, per night, six, seven bar, three or four restaurant. And
you go to six or seven bars a night?
Yeah. I mean, we're starting at, like, 12 noon.
Oh, okay.
So all
that,
day,
that seems
12
reasonable.
Hour.
Yeah.
No, and we try not to drink the entire cocktail, although they're beautiful and very tasty. the cocktail scene in London's pretty amazing. And I think just having this group of family that, you know, for me, if I don't bring anything new to the table, it just seems boring. Like, for me, it's always trying to find some, if I can bring something new to the table. It's a lot more fun, and it might not make any sense for people. It's like, well, why don't you just, you know, do more? You know,
slam the doors, yeah.
Yeah, and you make more money. But, mm-hmm. yeah, maybe I'll do that someday when I'm really desperate.
So we're lucky in that we get to be folks who work in a field where we actually, it's our job to be creative,
mm-hmm.
which is just such a privilege. And, you know, we talk about how maybe most Asian folks are supposed to be good at math and aren't necessarily seen as creative.
Yeah, well, it's all stemmed from the days in Berkeley. You know, I was in a high school in the Mission District, Mission High, and we, you know, the income level was pretty much the same. Everybody's poor. And you went to Berkeley, and there's, you really see the huge gap of, mm-hmm. of people come from wealth and so on. And like, literally, I remember seeing these people, and they want to be senator and doctor and president. And I didn't see that in when I was in this ghetto high school. Right?
Everyone was different colored but equally poor.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There was no discrimination.
Yeah. Like, you know, and we have five white guys in our class, and they're just as bad, just as poor. So when I went to Berkeley and back in the days, and it's funny now, it's less now, I've seen my son. But back in this, I went to college in 82, there was definitely a stereotype that Asians should do math and engineering, and I was sick of it. I love design, and I want to prove the world wrong that you could have design and be an Asian person. And that's when I saw the niches, like, why can't a really cool, hip design restaurant with Vietnamese food, and it's all about design, but you don't have to mess with the food. The food is, like, for me, the food should just stay, you know, true and specific to its culture. So it was in my head, and it was a frustration at first, then it became a niche, and it became an opportunity. And I can, you know,
niche to opportunity.
So I didn't want a Buddha in my restaurant. I didn't want a bamboo basket, red lacquer. All that stuff drives me nuts, you know. And not that I have anything against Buddha. You go to a temple to see Buddha. You don't need one in your restaurant. So that was always been my approach. And it, down to the wine we serve, part of the reason we call Slam Door is, like, we don't want you to have any pre-notion of what you're going to get.
Huh.
Like, it's just some, you know, it wasn't an Asian name, and you had no idea what it is. Sort of like the word Google. Well, now you know what Google is, but, you know, before that, that's the whole idea. So the wine, we were like, and we ended up doing Riesling here in the heart of Napa Valley.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and back then, 20 years ago, nobody was doing it. You know, we were the first guy, and we were chastised by the Napa people and saying, you know, you don't like us. And it wasn't really, not because I don't like Napa, but it didn't work with my food, so
yeah.
I didn't serve it.
Wow.
And we were really small, so, you know, I think there's the fridge. I got one three-door fridge, one for beer, two-door for wine. So literally I get about 20 bottles of wine that I can hold. Coal.
Mm-hmm.
And we become this focus on the Riesling, and become the king of the hill of Riesling. And I think that was strategically planning to make sure that you're good at something and you don't have to be everything. So although lately, in the last 5-6 years, you know, Napa Valley had changed and there's wine that go with our food.
Wonderful.
The alcohol has come down. It's mm-hmm. not high. It's not the big oaky Chardonnay or the big cap anymore. You got delicate wine that goes with the spicy food. So now we do have Napa Valley wine. But when we first started, it was that. We served creme brulee dessert. We just served Chinese tea. Literally 20 years ago, I was charging more money, $4 a pot. And the Ritz-Carlton back then was $2. And we were like, people were like, are you crazy? But we were buying these super expensive tea from China, for the first time. So, and people were upset at first, and later on they realized, oh my God, it's just so good. These oolong that from China, you know, prior to that, you know, nothing was coming out of China. The expensive oolong, we were paying $100-$200 a pound,
mm-hmm.
and we gave a lot of tea. So we would super anal about brewing less than 3 minutes and pulling mm-hmm. the basket out mm-hmm. and we have, you know, Kung Fu tea for tasting. And it was all about these little pocket things and that's why the name Slanted Door about, mm-hmm. just not.
Why is it the slanted door?
Well, a friend thought a door was slanted, but the whole wall was crooked.
Awesome. When did you come to this country?
I left Vietnam 75. I was in Guam, then 77 in San Francisco.
How old were you then? Not to place your age or anything.
Yeah, people can't do the math on radio. I'm 13 when I left.
Okay.
And I was 15 when I got to San Francisco.
So why did your family move?
Dad was Chinese, and he left China the first round, lost his... I have a half brother and sister through the communists. So the second time around, he wasn't going to wait again. So he runs again because he does not believe in communism. And
what did he lose?
He left China. Literally went through the back door and left his kid and his wife, and he never gone back. And
wow.
not until in the 80s he took him out of China again. So literally he remarried. So he left in 51. 1951, he met my mom in 61, so literally he was just kind of single and bounce around town to town for 10 years from northern China all the way to southern Vietnam.
He just left his family?
Yeah. They literally bang on the door. He jumped over a railing. They were coming after him. Luckily, he did. It was just, there were seven brothers. Him and number two uncle left. They ended up killing the number one uncle.
Uh-huh.
And two other uncle died from, you know, disease. And, but they literally, you know, he was wealthy in China, so they...
Oh, he was a good business person.
Yeah, cultural revolutions, and so he literally just ran through the back door and never came home.
What business was he in when he was in China?
You know, just merchant, selling, same thing in Vietnam, selling. That's why the Wuhing General Store, the restaurant that I named after, you know, the Chinese restaurant I named after, he was selling dry goods. He was selling anything.
So what does Wuhing mean?
It's his name and his brother's name.
Got it.
Hershing.
Yeah.
It's peaceful and prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
His name is prosperity. His brother's name is it's the Wu.
So then he escaped, and then he was living in
Vietnam. Northern Vietnam, mm-hmm. ended up like in the central region of Vietnam. That's where I was born, in Da Lat. He worked in the beef jerky business. He worked in a tea farm. Mm-hmm. He did everything. He was selling ice cream in Laos. You know, he was a merchant, so basically survived all those years. And then met my mom, opened up a little general store selling cookies and cigarettes and sugar.
And was it easy to be able to come to Guam and then to San Francisco?
It was a little crazy. Literally the day of collapse, April 30th, May 1st, 75. You know, the stuff you saw on TV, like the helicopter running off the embassy. We literally passed by the embassy and saw that, and got on a ship. You know, wandering at sea for 4 or 5 days, and got picked up by a Malaysian boat, and then transferred to Singapore. And then they transfer a bigger ship, and they ship you to Guam, and end up with 300,000 people in Guam in a mm-hmm. refugee camp.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, you can apply to come. You can get on a plane to come to other camp in the States or stay in Guam. We stay in Guam. Then this family took us out and worked for them. My dad was a janitor, helped them. That's how he got into the cleaning business. And then we stayed them. We promised to stay them for a year. Then we bought our ticket. When Pan Am still exists, and fly to from Guam to San Francisco, and we have some friends out here. Crazy enough, there's a bar here called Bourbon and Branch,
mm-hmm.
and it was in the Tenderloin. I literally lived like a block up, and I used to go, you know, with kids like going shoe shine. It was like that bar used to open at 8 a.m. with people like with drinking problem. We'd go in there,
really,
really stinky. So, but the Tenderloin in the 70s like that. But later on, Bourbon Branch converted to a hip bar. It's still a hip bar, but it's a rough neighborhood. You know.
Did it all feel like an adventure, or were you just terrified at times in this journey over to finally land in SF with your family?
Well, I was the oldest. Mom and dad, I mean, literally, we got out to open water, international water, and dad just said, Mom said, you know, if it ever happened to us, you're going to take over this family. So, and it was exciting. And at 13, I don't think you really grapple of how scary that is. And I keep thinking, you know, my dad died 85 when I was 40-something, and he was literally 40-something when he landed here. Imagine I'm 42 and I got 6 kids and not speaking a word of English and don't know what your life is.
Wow.
It's mind-boggling to kind of understand like how those people live and how your folks, what they're thinking behind, and it's amazing, you know. But it instilled on me a lot of ways, like the way I want to do stuff. Like I'm never afraid. Like I'm not afraid to open up an English restaurant. Because, like, I always say, think like a refugee. You know, just think like a refugee. Just don't don't rely on anybody's going to help you, you know, like don't sit around and wait for help. You know, if you're a refugee, you're on your own all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So you're bobbing out on the ocean and you're just going to find somewhere. So hopefully you don't drown. And I think in business, I carry that same mentality. It's just you just think on your feet and just trust it and go for it and make decision. And because I think you'll find strength if you starting to, I think, trust yourself a little bit more, you know, mm-hmm. because that's all you got, you know. I don't know how my dad was thinking, you know, what's he going to do with six kids, you know. Like he literally we're on this refugee boat, and this boat, the 400 people on this cargo ship, and he found, like, this stove, and there's a bamboo basket, and he barter and he soak it in diesel and burn it, boil some water and make some milk, and it was the only food we had. Somehow, you know, he get through, and you know, none of us got really hurt. But there's no manuals for you to how to operate a refugee boat.
How there's no manual about how to fix the grease trap when everything.
Yeah, so like that's, I think chef in general had that sort of mentality, and
we're all going down.
So you know, you're in the weed, you just do it, and you see in chef all the time, you know, where they like you got to learn how to be a plumber, because the plumber ain't coming, your toilet is overflowing, you got guests outside, and that's how I end up fixing things. I learn how to fix stuff all the time just because of that, because you just can't, you know. It's like a Broadway play. Every night at 5:30, everything goes up, you know, just that night, and it's adrenaline pumping. People are, you know, there's just so many times you can fix the problem before they get really pissed off and ran away from your restaurant. So whatever you need to do, make them a new dish, going out, you know, buy them a glass of wine, go up, say sorry, and really beg for forgiveness, and whatever you got to do. And I think that's sort of nature of this business, and because you always, you know, that's all you can do.
I see that. I'm not surprised to learn that your dad was a savvy business person in China, you know, before he had to sort of uproot his own life, because you had a pretty ziggy-zaggy path to going into food.
Yeah, I did. So dad came here, you know, he was janitor, and mom went to Chinatown, and dad actually wanted to get a grocery business, and he saw, like, he really see the town was changing. Edge of Chinatown, there was all these pornography store, and he was going after this one pornography bookstore, and he said he's going to go out of business soon. But unfortunately, he didn't get it, and it was Edge on Chinatown with Broadway and Stockton, and somebody else got it in grocery store, and then they ended up buying a sewing shop in 1982, and I went to college that year. Mom literally just learned how to sew. They don't know how to sew, and started a sewing business. And I think part of their thing is just that you can't work with people. You just got to have your own business. That's one way for you to leap bouncing. So I ended up doing the sewing shop. I went to Berkeley, and in fact, I took a sabbatical, went to New York, and worked for an architectural firm. They asked me to come back. I came back, quit school. I was in New York for a year with an architectural firm, came back, ran her business, and ended up designing clothes. And I took the business, grow it bigger, got more shop. I was doing, like, we have like 200 people working for us, and, you know, doing from O'Neill surfwear to Gunny Sachs dresses, and, like prom dresses and stuff like that. And then all came crumbling down, and we lost and went out of business, and we lost our money, went bankrupt, people didn't pay us. And then I took a little money and I traveled and I started, I was going to move to Hong Kong, and I decided not to, and I got a job selling software in Silicon Valley.
Oh, wow. Okay.
In 1992. And
you're the only other guy who's had more jobs than me.
Like early 90, like there weren't even browser, and like we were doing email with like Unix, and I was selling software for 2 years, and it was kind of exciting. it was great working for somebody and just getting into, this is like these 3D animations start to happen. SGI was happening. This is before Apple. And so Apple was just coming on, and that company went belly up, and I got my commission, $20,000, I was going to continue to sell software and go travel overseas, sell with SGI, and I decided to took that $20,000 and started Slandor in 1994.
Wow.
And by then, Slandor was in my head for about 10 years already, and I remember sitting at Zuni, you know, criticizing the salt and pepper shaker, and I looked around, and it was unemployed for about 8 months, and I found a space in the Mission, and it was just like I didn't care. Like there wasn't a restaurant there before, and I just remember talking to the owner, and there was a whole line of people waiting to get in, and somehow my senses tells me that he's the owner, and the real estate agent was like, there's a, you know, so I made a deal with him, bypass all these people.
Nice.
$2,000 a month rent. And I told him, I was like, look, I'll give you $2,000. Give me 4 months. If I don't get my permit, I don't get my money, you can have it back and keep my first and last. And literally that's how I made my deal. I just get up there, just shake the guy's hand. And I think that's something people got to do. You know, it's like it's a commitment. You know, you can't just always sit here and expect everybody to do everything for you and you don't do anything. So in this case, like I literally, you know, there has something to lose. I would lose $4,000 my first last month. But at the same time, in return, I get 4 months free rent to figure out if I can do this. You know, I could
proof
get a
of
permit.
Concept.
Yeah, if I can get my permit, I can get money to build it. Because you can't worry about too much stuff. And I always see chef and colleague in the business, and sometimes you got to start jumping and hoping there's something there you're going to land on. If not, you're going to get in the water, you're going to get back up, and you try it again. But that's how I did it, you know, like literally I had no idea. But I knew the location was good and the place was cool and hip and I could, you know, figure out how to build it. And it took me a year to build it. And I think I got another $40,000 from my family and I start racking up credit card debt. We opened a year later. Literally that restaurant cost $140,000.
Mm-hmm.
In today's term, it's really cheap.
Yep, and in today's terms, your empire of restaurants is one of the biggest grossing restaurant groups in San Francisco. I'm like so happy for you. I can't believe you came from, you know, that to this.
We're really blessed. It's almost 20 year, and this fall will be our 20 year anniversary. In fact, we got a book coming out, the Slander book. It's kind of coincide with this anniversary in October.
Oh, cool.
The book has a lot of story about how the company was built and the challenges. We lost a lease. We moved to Brennan Street, then we moved to Valencia Street. I mean, the Ferry Building. And one of the things I'm most gratifying is just when you ask me what I'm proud of, it's just I was able to cook my food and stay true to. I always want the food to have a story and have a grounding somewhere. It wasn't something I just made up. I did not believe in making up food. You need to get creative solving cooking problem, but the food has got to come from somewhere, a history and a story, culture. So, and I always feel like my job is to really bring pieces of certain culture, whether or not it's New Orleans fried oyster or English, you know, pot pie or a Vietnamese spring roll. Like, I believe in that style of cooking and methodology. And you learn the craft, you go to the place, you eat, like, you know, 14 beignet or 14 hush puppy, and you figure out what is the best and where the water table, and then you come back, and then you put your own sort of your choosing what is considered the best hush puppy. And that's how I believe food should be, because... and I know a lot of chefs today, it's more about technique and innovation. And there's a whole different school of way of thinking, but I'm more in the school of preserving sort of history and culture. And
speaking of, may I ask, you know, Asian food is becoming more and more specific. We're having something more than Asian fusion. I mean, you definitely started it 20 years ago, and now there's a lot going on with more authenticity with Asian food. And what's up with all these chefs being all about Japanese food, but not necessarily not as much about Thai and Vietnamese? And I'm Taiwanese, so I have to just throw that in there. Or even straight up Chinese food. You know, is there something about all of those sub cuisines that does not translate as well into fine dining?
Well, I think it just all—it's because our relationship to the Japanese and from World War II, and the fact that Japanese cultures are very prosperous and money. So, you know, even you get more Japanese knife than Chinese knife. But for years, the Chinese think they're the king and the Japanese are the lowlife, right? I mean, that's how the Chinese people think. And it's just all different point of view. And I think in time, like how you don't know anything about, you know, Palestinian food or Iraqi food, but you just heard about the war, and just like Vietnam War, mm-hmm. it's about exposure. Mm-hmm. And right now, Japanese food is super sexy, and they've got a lot of things. And sometime maybe the palate is more similar to the Mediterranean palate, the lighter, the raw fish, and the Chinese. But I think it in time it's going to change, and in time people are going to find, you know, really crazy, you know, Chiang Mai Thai food is interesting and unique. Because if you really dig down and having some, you know, pork that looks like cotton candy with some steamed rice, sticky rice, and scallion oil in Chiang Mai, or fried pork, it's just amazing. It was just like it's something they developed there. And yeah, I think statistic why people think, I don't think it's one thing is better. They might think it's better.
I like your metaphor with the burqa.
Oh, yeah. I was like saying you might not think burqa is the right thing to do, but at some point, maybe somewhere in the future, people might find burqa
sexy.
Sexy, you know.
Which makes me not have a lot of hope for Taiwanese food, because Taiwanese food to me is not like burqas. But that's a very funny metaphor.
But I think I see myself how a lot of the dishes, I don't think it was going to work in my restaurant. It's already changing. I remember serving daikon rice cake. I was like, nobody's going to buy this thing. This thing's so ugly.
But I love lo bo bao. I mean, lo bo gao.
Yeah, but this thing's so ugly looking. It's brown. It's pale. It looked like cement. And it's just like, but it's one of the best, I mean, most popular dish in at the Sliding Door. So I think people, as they travel more and open to more ideas and I don't think we're touching it. I mean, like, you're talking about the whole African continent. They're not even, like, all you hear is just, like, you know, people poaching elephant or something. Like, you don't even talk about, like, what kind of food they eat. And it's a whole different mindset of if you start eating that kind of food and the locale, why they use those herbs, why they, you know, they only have these certain spices. And sometimes it makes me sad. I opened two Chinese restaurants, didn't really fly. And sometimes it has to do with culture. And this country has some weird thing with Chinese, you know.
It has to be cheap.
Well, or they only want to eat it like Christmas with or New Year's Day with a Jewish family in New York City. I don't know. So
it's the last resort.
No. It's a good thing.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
And it literally, I think I saw a sign somewhere that says, you know, we don't know why you do it, but we love you guys, you know, that you want to eat Chinese food on Jewish holiday. But sometimes you just have to kind of deal with it. It's culture, and maybe there's certain bias towards that, and hopefully you can change that in time. You might not be able to change it now. Unfortunately, the Vietnamese thing, it literally went dormant after the war for a long time, and you even see it in film, like, you know, I think Deer Hunter came out a little bit, and you didn't see any Vietnamese film. Almost a big explosion. So sometimes it just takes a little longer to get to it, and it's just a matter of time that I'm not sure. I would hope that we will get to see all the food around the world be you know, prospers here because it's a beautiful world when you can eat, you know, Filipino food and turn around and eat some Polish food in the same neighborhood, you know.
Absolutely. I would like to talk about a cause that's close to your heart. You, speaking of proof of concept and getting an idea off the ground, you're simmering some way to fix the school lunch system.
Well, you hear this all the time. Kids got sucky lunch. they don't have enough money. Same old, same old. And
your kids feel the same way, right?
My kid will not eat the school lunches. So my idea is, okay, so the money is a problem. The U.S. government gives $2.50. There's no money in it. And don't wait for Uncle Sam to come anytime soon because he's quite busy and don't have money. So I think this idea is like using these models like Meals on Wheel or Share Our Strength, like you just got to create an entity that raises money to subsidize, maybe come up with another $2.50. Now you got $5 to make food for kids. That's one problem. The second problem is we don't have any delivery system or method. Long time ago, you have a kitchen and you hire a chef and they cook in every school. Well, that's not doable. They don't have kitchen. The kitchen's completely out of date. Most of these schools, not even ADA, you know, they have to spend thousands of dollars to make it ADA compliant. They're not even that. So they don't have the infrastructure. And on top of that, they don't have ways like control all these chefs, and it's just too many moving parts. So the idea is you would make the food at a commissary. But you have a hybrid system. You know, certain things would make at the commissary. Maybe the meat, the chicken would be braised. But you would have just light oven and fresh vegetable delivered to the restaurant, salad, fruit that somebody can just assemble. So it doesn't require a lot of skill at the school level. Just throw them in the oven, you know, bake the broccoli. And thirdly, I think we got to get away from this single package food that require a lot of waste. And when you have waste, it requires a lot of labor to package it. And when you have a lot of labor, that's part of the money too. So if you do food like family style and you let kids learn how to eat, and I know it's a challenge. There's a lot of allergy issues. And you can't just say, well, I'm not going to serve peanuts because, so you got to have different system go in to counterbalance those allergy issues, teach kid what to eat, not to eat. Because pretty soon, you're going to have allergy besides peanuts. You're going to have gluten allergy. You got all these different things. And you got to give people option and not just try to do everything with this sort of blank slate and these little frozen, nasty food that does not even look like food.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it should be sharing family style, you know, all over Europe. They eat that way. In China, they eat that way. That's why you have banquet family style. The food comes out hotter. You know, you don't have to scoop 50 scoop, right, for 50 people. You only have to do, you know, five if each bowl hold 10. So now you only plate up 10 plate rather than 50 plate.
Mm-hmm.
So my idea is just really, but you got to, you know, it's just this idea. I think you need to prove a concept. You got to do one school and hopefully, and also not relying on a single, you know, provider. I think it should be a community. It should be multiple. Should be there's a referee that have, you know, four or five companies feed these kids in the every location, because then you don't bank everything in one location.
Mm-hmm.
If something goes wrong, there's a contamination, you will out. You know, only one commissary have problem, and you're bound to have these problems when you got this many products.
That's
product
what that's happened to big food brands. Yeah.
Yes, yes. So, you know, you don't recall the entire chain, you know, because now you spread your risk all across the board.
So keep me posted on that.
Yeah.
I have some introductions to make. I did my research on you before we sat down here and asked around town about Charles Band. And a restaurateur tells me just sort of like a very fond story where he sees you. He saw you driving a truck around with, like, construction materials, and, you know, you were very dressed down, and you looked like you were going to go fix something at the restaurant. So, you know, is that what you do on your free time? You do a lot of handyman projects? I mean, you're just like a really wacky guy. I'm trying to paint a picture for our audience.
Yeah, I own a F-250 King Cab with a contractor rack, so I don't look like a chef. Sometimes I look like a contractor. I love to build things. I you know, we have a house in Napa, and I bought it half-built, and literally for 2.5 years, I go up every weekend and build part of the house, and it's not really good, and my craftsmanship's not very good, but it's dear, you know, when you come in and that crooked tile, every time you sit on that toilet, you reminded you that bad tile job you're doing. And for me, it's very, like, you know every inch of the restaurant, or you know every inch of your house. And it is very dear to me. I built every restaurant I own, I built from the ground up. Literally, I know what's behind each wall. I take pictures inside the wall. And I, you know, and I'm very hands-on, and I try to make things that are, will long, not last design-wise, but also longevity. And it's all about system. You make it easy for your staff to clean, and it's when everything's all gel, it's just cohesive and equilibrium, and it will just last a long time. And design and executions and food is all the same. When you're on, it's just great. And I think a lot of restaurant folks, you know, do their own plumbing. They just don't want to admit it. they don't want to tell their customer they've been sneaking that toilet in the back by themselves. And that's what it takes, you know, because restaurants are so immediate. Even you call the plumber, it takes like an hour or two, and you don't have 2 hours to wait. You know, if that toilet is just overflowing, you got to do it. You got to figure out how to do it, and you pretend nothing really happened so your customer don't see it. And that's how life is, you know. And
Charles says that he, before we sat down to talk today, he was on the roof of one of your restaurants fixing something.
Yeah, the roof. There's a leak, so I was up there with the roofer.
So
before I got here.
So with one more minute left in the show, you recently cooked at the White House. What was the coolest part of that experience?
It's not quite. I got to cook for the First Lady at the restaurant at Slandor, but at the White House, I was just doing a quick cooking demo for the Easter egg roll.
Mm-hmm.
Got to meet the First Lady, and she got a little photo op. She remembered me, gave me a hug, and was telling the president that how he missed out an amazing meal in San Francisco. And he said, yeah, I wish I can come. And I turn around and I go, Mr. President, you can always make me come here and cook for you. So hopefully I will get a chance to cook for the president. Definitely one of my favorite presidents. I do have a luxury to cook for President Clinton 3 times when he was in office.
Ooh.
And that was really fun. So so got to see 2 presidents. It's amazing. You know, God, man, he's got a hard job, you know, seeing his house. I don't envy any of it, you know.
Charles, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
I'll see you in New York at the James Beard Awards.
All right, we'll hit some party.
Absolutamente. As always, some social media info, hashtag WOMSHOW. At Leitishu, LEITISHU. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/ word of mouth with Leitishu, all spelled out. And Charles and his restaurant, his flagship, is at the Slanted Door. That was chef owner Charles Fan of the Slanted Door. Been around for almost 20 years, celebrating its 20th anniversary here in San Francisco. He's also got a bunch of other wildly different places. Check it out. You're listening to Word of Mouth with Leitishu on heritageradionetwork.org. We're recording from San Francisco on April 30th, 2014. And I'm your host, Leitishu. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit organization broadcasting over 30 live shows a week. To learn more and donate, visit our website or connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.